Greetings, and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the podcast that's best heard while soaking in a wooden tub with a beer in one hand and a baked apple in the other. I am your host, David Lloyd, and tonight's episode is about the Butcher of Blaviken himself and the surprise release of The Witcher 3 on the Nintendo Switch. Join me tonight at the pub, NWR Reviews editor, and man who just figured out the meaning behind the title of the Blood and Wine DLC, Mr. Jordan Rudick.
Hi, David. So I've played, we're talking about Witcher 3 tonight, I've played Witcher 3 when it first came to PS4, but to get ready for the podcast, I played the Blood and Wine DLC, which is quite sizable. And it took me to the end of the DLC to finally realize what the title is about, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later.
Perfect. And also at the pub, NWR site director and president of the Triss Marigold fan club, Mr. John Reardon.
Triss is best girl. There is no debate.
Well,
that's all I got.
John, I'm curious. We were just talking about the books, the Witcher book series before we started recording here. How does Triss in the books come across compared to how she comes across in the game?
So is it okay? We're talking about the third game in a series that comes after a long series of books. Can I give mild book spoilers? Like, is that fair?
You have given a warning here, so skip ahead if you don't want to hear mild book spoilers.
This is all in the first short story book, so I think it's fine. Yennefer likes Geralt, and Geralt likes Yennefer because they were cursed to always be drawn to each other. Triss likes Geralt because she actually likes Geralt. So, Yennefer is a horrible, abusive person. And Triss is a good person. Go with Triss.
It's hard to hate on or choose someone other than a person who has the last name Marigold. Marigold is a flower, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
It is.
So, a very poetic name, if there ever was one.
And she's just nice. Yennefer's so mean.
Well, I think the dark horse in all this is Kira anyway.
Yeah, she shows up a couple times in the books too.
She's my favorite so far.
You managed to not kill her from what I hear.
I did. So I was very happy with myself.
I thought I was going down the right dialogue tree.
You son of a bitch.
And then she was dead. So I reloaded.
There are no accidents in Witcher 3. There are choices and consequences.
This current Witcher 3 playthrough that I'm doing on Switch is my most flawless Witcher 3 playthrough to date. I have reloaded so many conversations to get the exact ending that I want now that I've gone through it a couple times.
Well, before we get too deep into the lore, Jordan, how about you start us off with what we're drinking tonight?
Sure. So I'll surprise you. Maybe John will surprise us too. I said last episode that I it's getting colder here, so I'm tending towards hotter drinks. But I figured we're playing a mature game tonight, right? Not a game for the kids. So I will have something alcoholic tonight, and that is a very simple. I had a bunch of cans of ginger ale in the fridge, and so I was like, okay, what can I make with ginger ale? Pim's Cup was one thing I was thinking about, but now I wanted something a little bit stronger than that for tonight. I'm recording another podcast after this one, God help me. But ginger ale and Crown Royal is what I went for. Not something I kind of regularly drink, but Crown Royal was one of the first alcoholic mixers or 40-proof drinks that I would partake in, Crown and Coke or Crown and ginger ale or something. So a little bit of a blast from the past for me. And we happened to have a small bottle, must have been a gift or something like that. So I threw a little bit in there, ginger ale and some ice, and I'm good to go. So that's I'm joining you tonight, David. I don't know. John, what about you?
How Canadian of you, though, Jordan?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Crown Royal and ginger ale. I don't know if...
I guess you'd
have to be sitting beside a beaver wearing a Mountie costume to be any more Canadian than you are right now.
Maybe that's why it got introduced to me, right?
That is how I picture both of you during all of these podcasts.
At least one of us is upholding that image for you. I'm not going to say which one, though.
The only thing left you have to do is use the Crown Royal bag as to hold your hockey pucks.
That's right. Okay, well, I'll leave that to you then, David. Is Crown, like, I know Crown Royal is a pretty Canadian drink, right? But people in the States don't drink. John, anyone drink Crown Royal in the States?
What?
It's whiskey.
Okay, I'm not super adept at whiskey, okay. So I'm not the person to ask. It doesn't immediately strike me as familiar, but that might just be my own inexperience.
To me, Neil is the resident alcohol expert, so I'll ask him, maybe.
Neil is just a raging drunk all the time. Mm. He just shows up in the chats, screaming at us drunkenly.
That's right.
Daily.
Well, an American would probably be upset if you didn't drink any other whiskey than Jack Daniels.
Mm. I've got a friend who drinks nothing but Jack Daniels, actually. Yeah, I feel like I only see him carrying around a bottle of Jack Daniels at all times.
Does he have at least have a Coca-Cola with him too?
Yeah, Coke or Diet Coke, maybe. One of the two.
Can you have a Diet Jack and Coke? That seems weird. I don't want a healthy Jack and Coke.
Maybe the reason he carries it around is because no one with the bars will make it for him, so he has to make his own.
Yeah, provide his own.
Right? Yeah.
Well, go ahead, John. It's your turn now.
I have... my old standby, a Guinness Extra Stout, which I just realized is missing one of its labels, and I don't remember if I pulled it off or if I bought it that way, and that's kind of weird.
Tastes the same either way.
It does. It's bitter and dark and delightful.
Just sounds a lot like Yennefer.
It loves me for who I am. Unlike Yennefer.
Okay, that's good.
It loves me for me.
Yeah. I have something not too off that, John. I went with another Quebec brewery, a Les Trois Mousquetaires. I went with the Porter Baltique, which is it's a dark lager that's closer to a porter, so it's actually not that much dissimilar from the Guinness. Mm-hmm. It certainly does not have the creamy head that a Guinness has, but this is, it's a pretty dark one. It's a 10%er, so it's nice and hearty. I know last week we were talking about the age, and they actually make a point of saying that it's been aged 3 to 5 years. So I thought that was interesting. But lagers, I saw the label, they called it a black lager, and I was thinking because of The Witcher's medieval setting, I wanted to pick up a lager. So it's I'm enjoying it. It's got a pretty intense taste, really. It's incredible flavoring. It's very bold and one of my favorite porters to date.
Yeah, without the label, I don't know what percent alcohol mine is. It's a mystery. I really want to know what happened to this label.
We can't trust the American label anyway because they water down your beer.
That's true. They just pee in it. That's just Coors Light and PBR.
Well... before we get into discussing the game or the story of Witcher 3, we should start with how Witcher 3 actually began or made its way to the Switch.
Do we know?
Do we know? We know it's on the Switch.
Yeah.
There's always been like a group of games that you've always kind of assumed would only run on a PS4 or Xbox or PC. I mean, it's no surprise that they're shocked to learn that the Switch does not have the hardware that those consoles have. So I know there's been a handful of games that you would just say are never going to make it. And until this was announced, Witcher 3 was definitely among them.
I'd say pretty high up on the list, too. I mean, I think it's probably one of the most technically demanding games of the generation. So it's one where, with this out, I have a hard time believing that there's anything that can't be brought to the Switch.
I mean, if you think about from the Switch launch to now, like, yeah, it seems to keep going up and up, right? Like, Skyrim. Okay, Skyrim was on everything. I could understand that.
Sure.
But then Doom after that, Diablo 3 after that, now The Witcher 3. We're getting The Outer Worlds probably early or middle of next year. All these big games that, yeah, I think that... Whoever is doing this, or they keep kind of outdoing themselves or figuring out maybe there's just expertise being shared, or people are kind of figuring out more and more about what they can actually do with this console through previous games they've made or something like that. I don't know. But yeah, Witcher 3 running on the Switch the way it does is super, super impressive.
Yeah, we might not know how it was made, but maybe, John, if you want to let us know what was done to get it onto the Switch. What things did you notice that were the compromises or the technical stuff? Like, what's the differences between playing this on a PS4 or playing on a Switch or Xbox? Yeah. Sorry.
So my first experience with it was on Xbox One when it came out, and I had forgotten about this, but I was looking up the resolutions for those versions when I was writing the review for this one, and at launch the Xbox One ran this at 900p. It was eventually like much later patched to do 1080, but it ran it at 900, and it definitely wasn't a perfect performance either, which makes the Switch's target of 720p that much more impressive, because that's the difference between the Switch and Wii U version of Breath of the Wild. Yeah. Like, that's not that big of a difference. Granted, the Switch docked targets 720, handheld targets 540, which is comparable to like the Doom or Wolfenstein ports. It has kind of that degree of softness, I guess. It's definitely noticeable when you're playing it on the TV. When I'm playing it in handheld, like 540 is obviously below the native resolution of the handheld system, but I don't seem to notice the downgrade anywhere near as much when I'm playing handheld. It just feels like the game. You do definitely get some texture resolution simplification. Some of the draw distances are pulled back on like foliage and stuff like that. But it still looks really good. Like, I mean, if you look at video of it or screenshots of it, like, they've done a really good job of prioritizing what makes this game beautiful and keeping that there. So, like, you still have, like, light rays coming through the trees. You get that nice, one of the things I really like about this game that struck me really early on is when you're out in the world and you have trees with the sun kind of behind them, you can see the light filtering through the leaves. It's not just like light on a solid object. Like there's kind of a transparency to all the trees, and even like stuff like that is preserved on Switch. There's still like real time reflections in the water, and it looks so much better than it should. And it's baffling just how thorough and complete a version of Witcher 3 is, to the point where I've considered just getting rid of my Xbox One copy, because I don't know that I'll go back.
Are the cutscenes are they the same resolution as the regular play? Like, is there a visible difference between when you walk up to a cutscene and when the cutscene plays?
There are a couple cutscenes now and then that are pre-rendered, they're also pre-rendered in the other versions. I think it's harder to tell in those versions. But no, for the most part, like any like basic cutscene, usually the cutscenes seem to hit 720 a bit more. I do notice more frame rate drops in the cutscenes. I think probably just because they're doing more stuff with like depth of field and probably using like high resolution character models and stuff like that for the close-ups. Because yeah, if you compare some of the cutscenes, like close-ups of Geralt's face, it looks like the exact same texture work and everything that's on like the PS4 and Xbox One. So they look really good. But yeah, they're all done in real time, and they still target 720 and tend to look very good.
That's good. And it's funny, one of the things I noticed today when I was playing, so I've been playing on the PS4 myself. I kind of had a chuckle at the way when it rains, the kind of mm-hmm. sheen that's on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, does it look about the same on the Switch for that?
It does. Yeah, it very like everyone just looks like they're very very sweaty.
Hmm. Yeah,
but yeah, I mean it's there, and that's the crazy thing is all of those little tiny touches. They might be lower resolution, but they're all still there. Like nothing was cut. You know what I mean? It's amazing.
When I was at PAX West in September, I played maybe 15 or 20 minutes of Witcher 3 in handheld mode, just to kind of check it out and see what it was like. And it really is incredible. I mean, we can't overstate this, but you know, it had been a few years since I played through it on PS4, but just yeah, kind of the one thing I wanted to do is I wanted to ride around on Roach and just see, kind of see the world and see, especially some of the water areas and go in the water, do some swimming and stuff like that. And it really didn't look that much different than my memory of the game. Like, it still was a beautiful, beautiful game. And this is in handheld mode. It would certainly be a way I would want to play through the game. And I've been so tempted this week, leading up to this episode that we're recording now. I've been so tempted to buy the game on Switch at full price. Like, even though I have the complete edition on PS4 Pro, which is where I actually end up playing the Blood and Wine DLC. But man, it just, again, another game that, like Skyrim, you just so much to do in it, and to really not be compromising that much at all and have this one on the go seems like such a great value proposition.
Oh, my productivity has dropped so much since this game came out. Like, there was a couple, like last weekend, I had all these things I wanted to accomplish, and I just sat on the couch and played this game. Like, nothing else got done, because it's having it anywhere is a problem.
I guess the only other thing I'm curious about with the Switch version is loading times.
They're just as terrible as they are in everything else.
Okay.
I mean, that's like the loading times in this game. Where I notice them and where they might be a little worse is like just respawning after death. I went through a kind of difficult part a couple days ago where I did die a couple times, and that did get frustrating, where you're looking at probably above a minute of loading to respawn. In general, unless you're fast traveling a lot, which I don't really fast travel, I tend to just ride to wherever I want to go, loading isn't really a problem. You just get a nice long load when you first start up the game. But other than that, it's not too bad.
I think we went over the difference between the ports, between the different systems. Why don't we jump right into the game itself, The Witcher 3. Why don't you give us a backstory? The one thing I've noticed about Witcher 3 is I often feel like there was a story, or there was like I feel like I'm kind of coming partway into a story. And maybe Johnny can give us some context of how this story fits into the Witcher world.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely, I think they do as good a job as they can, because that's it's a weird thing, because I was thinking about when the Switch version came out, I was like, yeah, it's going to be weird for Switch players, because the first two games, obviously there are books as well, but the first two games where a lot of people were introduced to this also aren't on Switch. But then I realized that they're not on PS4 either, and only the second one is on Xbox. Like, so the vast majority of players, regardless of their console, came into this partway through, whether that was through the second one or the third one, because the first one is still only on PC. And I think they do a good job of giving you enough information to get by and to follow the plot. And they do give you a lot of extra character information in your glossary if you're curious about a character. But yeah, it's kind of just the fact that you're going off a series that's 7 or 8 books long, and then 2 prior games worth of lore. And so there is going to be a certain barrier in the more, you know, intricate elements of the lore. But the game kind of tells its own story. It doesn't seem to rely on that too heavily. But I'm also coming at it from the perspective of being more experienced with that. I guess when this game came out, I hadn't played the first one, but I had played the second one, and I had read the first book. So I'm coming at it from the perspective of being somewhat familiar with the lore when I first played it, and being more familiar with it now. So I may not be the best person to ask about whether it's approachable.
So I can answer this a little bit. And it's one thing about the game that really impresses me. I came into Witcher without I mean, I think I played maybe 20 minutes of the second game on Steam or something like that. Kind of bounced off it. Wasn't really a fan of the way it played out. I probably didn't give it much of a fair shake, but at any rate, it wasn't nearly as accessible as The Witcher 3 is. You open up with that great tutorial that teaches you about kind of fighting monsters and knowing, you know, okay, I need to look at my lore, or I need to look at the bestiary to figure out what are the ways to fight these different creatures that I'm going to encounter. But the thing that really sticks with me about Witcher 3 and what makes it accessible is the fact that throughout the entire game, and including the DLC, you are constantly learning about the world, about the creatures that inhabit it, and especially you're learning about Geralt himself. You're always meeting people that he knows or that are aware of him or want to ask about witchers and what do witchers do. He's often explaining parts of his backstory or his history or his profession, right? He's always talking about maybe prior conquests or the things he's seen and done, right? Or meeting people that reminisce with him. Oh, hey, Geralt, remember the time we did this? Or when we went to this place and we, you know, we were doing all this crazy shit? Like, that's constantly happening everywhere you go. And it speaks to what I think is the strongest part, and this is one of your questions here for our topic, David, our favorite part of Witcher 3, and it really is the world that you live in. It's huge, first of all. It truly is an open world. There's so many different things you can do, people you can see. But you learn so much about you learn so much that makes you feel like this is a living, breathing world, a place where you could go and, you know, you could exist like human, like humans in the game exist, you know, like they all have lives, they all have stories, they all have, life to them. And that to me is the most fascinating part of the game. And I think it's super accessible because wherever you go, you're always learning something about who you are. And so Geralt isn't a blank slate, right? You can play him as a, you know, maybe a more good character or a better one, or somewhere in the middle, right? But you learn about who he is and who the things he's done. And I think to me that's just the most interesting part of the game.
Yeah, I would agree, because I'm in the same boat where I hadn't played it before. I had started Witcher 3 a few months ago, I think during a lull, just to kind of give it a try, and I didn't get too far in. I think the one thing was that I was worried about becoming overwhelmed, just because at the beginning, you're kind of starting off like partway into a story almost, where they're like he's tracking Yennefer right off the bat. And you can tell that there was obviously some history between them. And then you get to kind of that first village, and then the character that I can't remember his name, the character that he was with.
Vesemir.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Vesemir. Like there's a history there too. And then even the tutorial with Ciri and Yennefer, and then kind of being confused at how it ended. And so it was it doesn't take long to, like you said, because it feeds you all the back information as you're playing. Like it's clear that they assume that you haven't played a Witcher before, because they do fill in all the blanks as you go. But yeah, I did feel like I had to get a few hours in to kind of get enough backstory to feel like, okay, this isn't just going to be kind of working on a new story where you're not going to really understand the context, because there's so much there's so much that happened. Mm-hmm. Like they fill in the context, and the fact that the context is fed to you, yeah, is one of its main strengths.
I mean, in a 100+ hour game, I think you almost expect that. You expect that you got to play about 3 to 5 hours before you really get your feet underneath you, because it's just, again, the world is so big. There's so much happening in it, so many people to meet, so many things to learn about it. They did build it for people that haven't played before. It's the first Witcher game to come to 3 platforms, now 4, right? But again, it's going to take a little bit of a little bit of that hand holding at the beginning, or a little bit of time and patience to kind of understand where you are here, or what you're going to be doing, who exactly Geralt is in this world. But yeah, I mean, there's just so much content that I don't think that's surprising.
And I can see where the beginning especially would be overwhelming, because they throw a lot of systems at you. Like, beyond just the basic, I mean, there's kind of the investigative stuff, but then you're also like gathering resources to get bait for that griffin. And I think they introduce you to like blade oils and alchemy and all this stuff that is ultimately totally optional to the entire game, which is one of the things I really like about it. There's an incredible amount of depth that you can totally ignore, which I like. I think David, you were doing a quest at one point where you were talking about having to kill a wraith about
on the aisle.
Yeah, and going into your bestiary, like you were having trouble with that fight, and then went and looked up what this sort of creature was and what they were weak to, and found that a certain sign would affect it. Signs are Geralt's like kind of magic abilities, and then use that, and the fight's super easy. And so it's like if you're willing to do what Geralt would do and research what you're fighting and then prepare for the fight, it makes the game much easier, but it doesn't force you to do that, and you can choose not to if you don't have any interest in that.
Yeah, like that particular fight, it wasn't impossible to win the way I was playing. It was essentially like I figured out how to use the fire sign to, there was like these bugs that she was sending at me, and then so I'd have to kill them, and then I'd have to slash her with the sword, and so I was just kind of doing that for a bit. And then yeah, you had mentioned that it's important to read the bestiary, so I'm like, all right, I'll take a look. And then it told me to use a Yarden, so I used the trap, and I ended up killing her in like 3 hits where I was like spending like 20 minutes in a previous fight. So it made it much, much simpler. But like, again, it wouldn't have stopped me from going, but just the fact that I used it made my life a whole lot easier. And it actually ended up helping. And later, because just recently I came across a vampire, and so I looked up and saw what they were weak to. And again, it just made life easier, I guess. Not impossible, but easier.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can use, I mean, they, like, sometimes it's just like a simple, you know, here's the magic they're weak to. But it'll go, like, I know there's a quest where you're going after a werewolf, and they're like, yeah, there's a certain, you know, blade oil that will do extra damage to them. And so if you go and gather all the resources and make that blade oil, it'll make that fight really easy. And it kind of makes the game, like, you can kind of tailor it to if you're not as good at the combat or don't want to spend as much time on the combat, you can put that focus in other places and make the combat kind of superfluous. Which I like. It lends itself to very different play styles, which I think is cool.
And I actually did that about halfway through the Blood and Wine DLC. I've been playing on maybe the normal or the hard difficulty to start off with, whatever the default is. And then I switch it down to like just the story, I think it's called, or something like that. Where,
yeah.
And you know what? Like, the truth is, it makes the combat fairly easy. Not like a cakewalk. There's still some fights where you have to think about it. You can't just mindlessly, you know, jam the square button or whatever the fast attack or strong attack buttons are. But yeah, if you want to keep it on normal or hard or you know, one of the harder difficulties, and then go to that trouble, right? Go to the trouble of collecting what you need to make the oils or have the right potions and figure out exactly what the monster's weaknesses are. You can do that. And that, maybe that choice for realism versus accessibility is great. You'd love to see things like that. And I've had experience with both, and I think the story is so bloody good that, yes, you know, don't feel ashamed or don't feel like you shouldn't put it down to the easiest just to enjoy playing through the narrative here and meeting all the characters and seeing the world. It is absolutely worth it. If anyone's listening right now and they're not, you know, a huge action RPG fan, believe me, you can get through this game by putting down the difficulty, having a little bit of patience, and it will certainly be rewarded.
Well, and while we're talking about the combat, I would probably consider the combat in Witcher 3 to be its biggest weakness. I just felt like everything else is so grandiose and so much fun, but battling, there's definitely a get-good aspect to it. Like, you can really, if you take your time and figure out all, like, be patient and figure out the moves, you can be quite expert, like an expert at the combat, and things will be easy. But I just found that the actual movement is a little clumsy in like the way he kind of does. It's kind of like fencing in a sense, the way he uses his sword, where he has a block and then there's like parries and pirouettes and that sort of thing. But I just find like a lot of fights, like I was inside a building once, and I had like five or six people all trying to slash me at once, and I found like all I was kind of doing was just slashing and jumping, trying to avoid getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of fights where it just felt clumsy. It just felt like mashing buttons.
Well, it doesn't help when you're inside, the camera doesn't always do the best job of not kind of getting caught up in a corner somewhere.
Yeah, because it felt like the camera was spinning. Mm-hmm. Like especially inside, like once you're indoors, that's where I found the most difficulty. And I mean, usually when I was going inside, I was like massacring everyone in the building, so that didn't help either.
Maybe the problem is that you're trying to kill everyone.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the combat.
I was not playing a diplomatic Geralt.
David, you can just talk to people sometimes. You know, you can persuade them not to get angry.
Push A.
That's right. I specifically remember early in the game where there was, I think it was like the first village that you encounter on your own, like with your part Vesemir gone. I had just finished a big barroom battle where I ended up having to leave that village because of that battle. So the next village I ended up in, the first thing I did was went to a bar and got a drink, and these bandits showed up and started mouthing me off, and I chose the shut your mouth before I cut your head off option, and it didn't take long before I was fighting six guys and left all the bodies on the floor, and the bartender told me, hey, I better leave out the back door.
See, now the game is giving you an exit, right? They're giving you a way to get out of these situations. You can just, you know, buy them a drink or say, you know, hey, man, you know, let's not have a fight here. Let's just calm down. Cooler heads prevail. You're putting yourself in that situation that you don't like, right? I know your Canadian blood is compelling you to fight them, right? To drop the gloves, but you don't have to fight everybody. That, I mean, that's the great thing about the game, right? Is that you really can play it the way you want, right? If you want to focus on the quests that are, the monster hunting quests, right? Where you're collecting bounties, you can do that. If you'd rather focus on the, maybe the more mystery ones where you're investigating, you know, how did this murder happen, you know, and collecting clues and stuff like that, you can do that. There's so much variety in terms of the quest structure in this game. That's another huge selling point of Witcher 3.
Yeah, and there's another instance later on in the game, which might be too spoilery, so I won't give details, but suffice to say there was a building, and there was a plan, a strategic plan going into the building, and partway through the plan, I had asked John if there was any repercussions if I had just butchered everyone in the building instead of actually going through with the plan, and his response was, go nuts. So there was about 30 bodies left, and I burned the building down on the way out.
And I only say that because I myself have never managed to get through that quest without... like, I assume you can do that quest without burning the building down, but I've never, never got there.
Yeah, I looked it up, and there are options to get out diplomatically, and it actually makes your life easier.
But
It wasn't the way I roll, let me tell you.
Yeah, you get, that's, and Jordan mentioned this earlier, the story and characters are just so good that you grow attached to them, and then you get into situations where it's like, well, the smart thing for me to do from a game perspective is nothing, but I don't like what these guys are saying about this character that I like, so I'm gonna burn their house down.
This is a good opportunity for me to, pimp one of my past projects. For my master's degree, I wrote a paper on Dragon Age and Mass Effect where I talked about decision making. And one of the conclusions or one of the things I pointed out was that often in these RPGs, making the morally good decision or what would be maybe the most satisfying decision, not killing everybody, but just like, you know, kind of nicely wrapping up things, you know, neat little package kind of thing, requires a lot of effort. So it might be that, okay, to prevent the building from burning down, to not kill 30 people, to not have, you know, 30 minutes of combat that you don't like, you have to go through all these meticulous details and really make a lot of, you know, maybe keen or tricky decisions or something like that. The same thing happens in Mass Effect, where you want to save all of these people and make your life easier, but it requires all these intricate steps, and it's very hard to do to make that happen. I think The Witcher 3 does that really well as well, right? Where you are put into quests where there's so many different outcomes, but the one that might be the best one requires planning, it requires good decision making, or maybe it requires timing on your part. There's all these things that go into reaching those optimal outcomes. Not necessarily the easiest way to do those, but I think if you wanted to really look into each quest in detail and say, okay, like I've got 2 or 3 hours tonight, I want to really dissect this, and I want to see all the possible endings here. I want to figure out if I do this, what is that going to lead to? Just kind of like mapping it out in your head, you know. I think The Witcher 3 gives you those opportunities to do that, which is really cool.
Yeah, and it's funny too. Like, this is a 100-hour RPG, but it's a highly replayable 100-hour RPG. Just like you said, like you could play multiple times, take on different quests, attack the quests differently, like. There's so many. I've probably put in 30, 40 hours now. I don't, like, obviously I'm probably not even halfway done, but I've mainly stuck to the main quest, but I can already see how I could have done things differently. And I can see, like, there's quests that actually fail because if you, like, you choose one quest over another, you choose certain relationships over another, or setting stuff up with people. So I can already see, like, oh, okay, I could play this again and see a whole different story almost.
Yeah, and it does have, there are multiple endings and multiple, like there's multiple endings for various aspects of the game. Like there's an ending for Geralt, but then there's also an ending for whatever romance options you do. There's an ending politically for what happens to the world. And so you wind up with this ending that's a combination of many different things. So you could replay the game and do a lot of it the same and get mostly the same ending, but then switch some little part of it out to kind of fine tune your perfect ending. Cause there is not, there's like, I don't think there's a canon good ending. It just has a lot of them and you can kind of choose.
It'd be interesting too, because I noticed when I first started the game, they actually had the option of transferring your save from the second Witcher.
Which only works in the PC version, but it is a button in every other version, including, like, which I thought was weird, the Xbox version, the Witcher 2 is backwards compatible, but I don't think you can use your old save on that. So I enjoy that they act like that's a possibility in every version.
It's just a
despite
big tease,
it totally
then.
Not being, yeah.
I was gonna say that it seems like throughout the story or some of the major side quests, you get these opportunities to make really, really difficult decisions. And there's one in the Blood and Wine DLC, kind of near the end, maybe the last, you know, 20-15% of the game or something like that, where you have to decide if you're going to kill this kind of this major vampire who's the villain of the DLC, or if you're going to try to find a way to help him. And the world map, it creates two objectives, right? You've got the main objective, and then you've got the optional one, kind of the good or the bad, maybe, or that you've got the, clearly you see the two waypoint markers on the map, and you've got a choice to make, right? Are you going to go left or right? And I think there's, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys have probably come across a bunch of those, just playing the base game, or John, you finishing the base game, you get those opportunities to make really, really gut-wrenching decisions, like, you know, do I want to save this person, or do I want to kill them, or do I want to, you know, side with one side politically or the other? How do you guys rectify those, or how do you make those decisions? What do you go for?
I know, like, so I'm gonna get a very, like, the decisions that I've found I'm paying more attention to this time around are honestly, like, the smaller ones. Like, I generally, like, the main character decisions I feel pretty good about most of the time, and I kind of just go on instinct. What I didn't realize the first time I played through this was how many random little side quests that I would do or ignore without really thinking about who the people were asking me to do them. Like, how much that would ultimately affect my ending. Like, not paying attention to, like, okay, this guy wants me to do this. and not necessarily realizing, okay, that guy works for Radovid, so by doing this, I'm helping that side do this and this and this and this. And that winds up affecting so much more as you go in, and those will be tiny little side quests. And so this time through, I'm being way more aware of kind of the political ramifications of doing every quest, and which side I'm ultimately helping, because I'm trying to get a very specific ending this time around.
I know for me, I'm going, all my decisions are pure emotion. I've been sticking to the main quests just because for the sake of this podcast, I was trying to get as far as I could into the game. So I wasn't straying off the beaten path too much, but I can already tell the side quests that I'd be doing are the ones that I was emotional over. Like there was one with the Baron, like the ending of the Baron's quest, where I was telling mm-hmm. John, I'm like, the first chance I get, I am going to go kill those motherfuckers.
Yeah. What,
David, that's your solution to everything.
Did you, I'm trying to say this in ways that are in not spoilery. Did you free the spirit that's tied to that quest line in the hill, or did you kill it?
I killed it.
John, you know the answer to that question. If you're going to ask him, like, did you do something yeah, nice,
I should,
or did
I
you
should.
Murder everybody?
I'm just trying to figure out which, what ultimately happened at the end of that quest line for David.
Yeah, so in the hole, the entity was pleading with me to let it go. I did not trust him one bit, so I massacred him. And
you have no remorse. You're just a killing machine, David.
No, I had no remorse. I butchered him up and took away his carcass.
I mean, truly playing the butcher of Blaviken, right? Like as you mentioned in the intro here.
Yeah, and then I headed back to get my reward, and then realized that the people that had sent me were just as bad. And if they were on the quest, I would have gladly have taken pleasure in decapitating all three of them. But it had to wait because I needed to get far into the quest. But I think as soon as this episode's done, I'm going to be mounting on Roach and slicing up some hags.
That I mean, you will get the opportunity. That does come back up.
Yeah, and I just the last thing I did today in my latest playthrough is I got a very fancy sword from an elf, and I'm keen to use it.
Maybe just before we move on to some lasting impressions of the game, I did want to make one more note about the choices in the game. I know I'm kind of beating this to death a little bit, but there's something interesting about whether you make the choice from a David perspective, a John or a Jordan perspective, or you make it from Geralt's perspective, right? Because he's not a blank slate, he is his own character. Do you make the choice that Geralt would make in this situation, or do you make the one that you would make in this situation? I think that there's a conflict there. And it's, again, it's not going to happen to everybody. If you're David, you just automatically click the one that's, you know, at the bottom of the list where it uses the word die or kill or murder. But I think a lot of other players might see it as, you know, who is actually making this choice, right? Geralt is going to say this. The voice acting is really good across all the characters you meet in the game, especially Geralt. I really like it. And it makes him feel real. It makes him feel, again, like a person in this world who is going to carry the weight of these decisions. He's going to be affected by what happens here. So can I make the decision just see, because I want to see what happens, or should I consider how Geralt's reputation is affected by this, right? I mean, obviously we're thinking a little bit more maybe outside the scope of the game or something like that. But it is something that I think about when I play a game like that.
No, I agree. And actually, I feel like there is, a lot of the times it is obvious the way that Geralt would answer it. Mm-hmm. Because they, especially with the way that his history is kind of shown through all the cutscenes and through all the backstory that you get, you kind of get an idea of what his personality is. So even when you're making the decisions, I don't necessarily feel like I'm shaping his personality, because I think a lot of his personality is shown through those interactions from the past. Like especially when they're going through like the history with, there's one great one where he's discussing like his backstory with Ciri. And I think that kind of gives you a window to his personality quite a bit. So as the options come up, you can kind of get an idea of the different ways that he would answer. And like you said, even when you do things like, I mean, one of the things is that the Yennefer versus Triss sort of storyline, where I think they do a good job of making it seem like either one makes sense for him, like going in those routes. Like, I think for the most part, you can kind of play by your personality, but I think they've done a good enough job that you still feel like the decisions make sense for him to a certain extent.
I think the writing and the voice acting helps that a lot, right? The writing, whatever choice you make, you feel like it's written in such a way that, okay, Geralt is saying that this is okay. This is something he would have done. And again, the solid voice acting kind of adds to that as well.
Yeah, I don't think you can't really break Geralt's character based on your dialogue decisions. I always do what's best for Geralt. That's how I make those choices.
I feel like
I just want him. I want my precious boy to be happy.
I feel like he is a mercenary, right? Like when you get opportunities to ask for more gold, or to make deals that would line your pockets. Like, I feel like that's the way he should go. He's a mercenary for hire. Why wouldn't you make those decisions, right?
He's got a cold exterior, but he's got a soft heart, you know?
But that could be, again, but that could be your Geralt, though, John, right? Like, there's no way David's Geralt has a soft heart. He has a heart.
No, David's Geralt needs someone to talk to.
He's got, like, the small Grinch heart before it enlarges, you know?
Yeah.
He's got friends.
Yeah.
Less enemies.
I think his friends are probably terrified of him.
What I say that you can't break the character through your dialogue choices, but David's Geralt might be more of a psychopath than Geralt was ever intended to be.
He's getting very close. Eventually, Geralt's just going to tell you to piss off and just do his own thing, David, I think. Why do you keep putting me in all these damn battles?
I'm tired. I'm old.
I'm telling you, the one funny thing though is I keep breaking equipment, and it's very obvious why.
That's something I don't like about the game, actually. Like I don't like in general equipment degradation. I can tolerate it, but it's another annoying part of the combat, I think. Can I say one thing about the combat actually that I was thinking about when we first started talking about it? Man, I really wish it was Dark Souls combat, or specifically Bloodborne combat. Like, we're going to still talk about where does Witcher 3 kind of stand up in the pantheon of RPGs, but man, I would love to see that in a Witcher 4 if the combat were closer to a Soulsborne type combat system.
See, I'll defend the combat just because I like how quick and fluid it is. And I definitely think there are elements where you can spot that this was a PC game first. Not as much so, like, it's not as obvious as it was in the second one, where it really felt like a PC game just mapped to a controller. But I honestly really like the combat.
I just find it kind of janky. Like, I feel like when you hit people, it doesn't always feel like you hit them, you know? Especially when you hit them and they block it, if you feel that. But when you land a successful blow, I feel like it's really muted compared to, again, you know, the Dark Souls games where it's very visceral. You know you got a hit in. Like, there's blood that spurts out. Yeah. There's that sound of the contact. But you don't get that as much in Witcher 3. That is something I think is a little bit lacking. I don't not enjoy the combat. I just feel like the small parts of it, the sounds, the feel, is a little off.
You feel when Geralt cuts off legs and arms, though.
Yeah, but
dismembers?
Yeah.
That's a good
time. Yeah. Yep. When body parts come flying off and you see it and the blood is spurting out everywhere, you do feel those ones. But, I mean, that's not most of the attacks, right?
No. I know what you're... I've had the same feeling, too, where you sometimes even wonder if you got the hit in.
Like, I have to look at the life bar to know if I did damage. I don't like that. I want there to be cues in the game that told me, yeah, that was a successful strike. Do that again, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if I don't see them block it and my sword goes through them, I assume that worked.
Yeah.
we could keep talking.
Well, John, I think you've clearly put the most time into Witcher 3 of the three of us. Like, what keeps bringing you back?
Oh, it's the story. I mean, and the world, I have issues with, like, the actual world design of this game. I think it's too cluttered. But, like, the Witcher universe as a whole, I love it. I love all the characters and the, yeah, I mean, I could just sit and watch the cutscenes from this game. But it would drive me crazy because people wouldn't be making the decisions I want them to make. So it really is just, I think it's, there's always that debate of story versus gameplay in games. And I think Witcher 3 is a great example of a game that manages to have a very complex and deep story that legitimately affects the game while not just being an interactive movie. Like, there's a whole lot of gameplay in Witcher 3. It's certainly not Uncharted. And I think that's what I really like about it.
Jordan, what's your biggest takeaway from The Witcher?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be the characters, maybe the design of the story, the design of the side quests, all of the things you do that maybe you wouldn't call them gameplay. Like, it's the narrative that you flesh out, that you explore, that you expose. I love so much of just running around, finding a person, and thinking they're just some random NPC. But they lead you on this wild goose chase, and it's really, really entertaining and affecting, right? I don't know that there's another game I've played where I felt like I got to the end of the story, the main story, and I felt like there was so much I could have done differently or so much I didn't do or hadn't done. I feel like it's like reading a book and you're reading only every second or every third page or something. You kind of get the overall gist of it. But you're missing so much of that detail, and I guess it's one of the truly, truly a desert island game, just the way you could go so many different ways with it. So I guess that, to me, the way the narrative is, the writing is so good, and just, yeah, the world feels so real. It feels so genuine, and I'm in awe of. I played like 15 minutes of the DLC. I finished it through. But I skipped basically all the side quests. I skipped so much of maybe what could be really enjoyable to me. So, going back to the main game is one thing, but even just going back to this Blood and Wine DLC to do all the small things there, like, I'm looking forward to doing that too. So, yeah, it's the story and the narrative for me that really lasts with this.
And that Blood and Wine DLC is, they could, that's like a Xenoblade Torna level DLC. They could pop that on a disc and call it a game.
Absolutely. The DLC, yeah, by itself it may be one of the best DLCs I've ever played. It is, actually. It's one of the best. But this, yeah, new area, this Toussaint area, kind of a French themed one. I mean, it's gorgeous. There's just so many, yes, cool, the way the city is designed is really neat. You know, it's kind of got a lot of vertical space, and it's kind of winding paths up kind of up a cliff or up a mountain. Really, really neat place. And there's a couple other smaller areas that the DLC takes you to as well. Like, you go to this kind of fantasy world, you get trapped inside a book.
Yeah.
And you meet all these like fairy tale characters, like Goldilocks and the three little pigs and the big bad wolf. It's hilarious, but it's so unexpected. And when I first got into this, I was like, oh, it's the end of the game. Near the end of the game. Like, why am I doing this little thing? And it turns out to be like a 2-3 hour diversion. And it had its own side quest inside it. I was floored, yeah, by it. You know, it's just an amazing, amazing amount of content and worthwhile content in this game.
Yeah, I remember getting to that point and just having to like kind of break from the quest for, yeah, a while and just walk off in a direction and be like, how big is this,
yeah,
submap?
Yeah.
Because this seems,
exactly,
huge.
Yeah, I mean, just looking out from where you're standing to looking out on the horizon, like, you want to go to,
yeah,
the edge of it. You want to go to the edge of this map and really see that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so unnecessarily huge. And it's, I love
there's,
it.
There's not a lot of filler here. Everything that's in this,
yeah,
game seems meaningful, seems worth doing. And for a game this huge, so many hours of content in it, for everything to be enticing, enjoyable, yeah, that's a very, very special game.
Yeah, it's. I think we're all kind of on the same page, where, because my biggest thing is the exploration and the story of the world. Like, that's what makes me want to continue playing. Like, for to give an example, the very early on, there's a quest where you have to go to, there's like a wraith that's poisoning a well, and it's this little tiny village that you're sent to. You can see that something bad happened at the village, and so the whole point is you go there and you're supposed to figure out, well, how do I get rid of the wraith? Well, you have to figure out what happened to the village, then you have to find the reason the wraith is still there. So you kind of do, you know, the detective mode, I like to call it, the Witcher senses,
mm-hmm.
Where you kind of look around, you figure it out, then you use your bestiary to figure out how to defeat the wraith, you defeat the wraith, you know, cleanse the area. But even when the quest is over, you're still learning more, because you end up meeting up with a character later on who then explains what happened to the village, like the backstory behind to, like, why is everyone dead at this village? Why was there a wraith to begin with? So, yeah, it's just, there's so much to explore. I think you kind of hit the nail with the, if there was ever a desert island game, like, this might be it, because there's just so much to explore and so much to do. And then you could do it again and get different outcomes.
Completely different, yeah. Yeah. I thought for sure, David, you were going to say your lasting impression was the death and destruction of everybody, but...
I will, that detective element, I think, is one of the most unique, as far as just, you know, weird things to have in an RPG. I mean, you have games like, you know, the Batman Arkham games and L.A. Noir, where you have that detective element. But having it in a world like this, I can't think of another RPG that does it quite like Witcher 3 does. Where pretty much that's kind of every quest, is you get told about something, and then you have to piece together what's going on before you can ultimately solve the problem.
Yeah, and maybe just to conclude the discussion, I haven't finished it. Like I said, I'm probably halfway through, so I can't really comment on what I would want to see in the next game. But since you guys have already played through The Witcher and you played the DLC, maybe if you guys could just tell me, like, if, you know, the likelihood is there's going to be a Witcher 4. Are you just wanting to see, like, do you want to kind of have it par for the course, but with a brand new story, brand new world? Or do you want to see same world, but maybe new people, or maybe focus on different things? Like, what is it that you would like to see in a Witcher 4?
There's part of me, with the ending of this game, kind of regardless of which one you get, there's part of me that honestly says just be done. I think this game has a really good ending for a very long-running franchise. And I'd be totally fine if this was the last one. If they do keep going with it, I think you have... When Breath of the Wild got announced, it got a lot of comparisons to Witcher 3. And I think those are fair. But I think that if there's a Witcher 4, I think there's things that it could ultimately learn from Breath of the Wild in terms of its world design. And I think I'm probably crazy for this, but I've always felt like the world of Witcher 3 was really cluttered and cramped despite being huge. I feel like I'm constantly dodging around trees and there's just stuff everywhere, and all the towns are really close together, and it's big, but it doesn't have a great sense of scale all the time. And so I think it could veer a little bit more toward Breath of the Wild while still having, like, the giant cityscapes and stuff like that, and that would be really cool. I'd also be okay if you just played as Ciri for the entire game, because Geralt's getting up there, and he's got to retire eventually.
Yeah, I can't... I agree with the first part of what you said, John, but I can't agree with that last statement. I think Geralt is such a compelling character. I'd hate to see a Witcher game... I mean, maybe they could do the same thing with Ciri. I'm not saying that would be a bad thing. It could very well be even better, but I'm just so interested in Geralt as a character, and I think he makes these games just with who he is, and you know, seeing the world through his eyes, making decisions through his eyes as well. I like the combat to be a little bit different. Again, I think I've made it clear, like, my position on where what kind of series I'd like it to be like. In terms of the world, yeah, if I wasn't constantly running into things, if I wasn't constantly being bombarded with obstacles and people and things to do and see, Just spread them out a little bit more, you know, like give me more open fields, give me more big open roads that I can ride Roach down, something like that. I don't know. There's not a lot that I want to see changed. It really is an amazing game, and in some ways I think it is perfect. Maybe not overall, but there's some things like the story, the characters, the way you contribute to the narrative and make decisions. I think those are maybe perfect. And I wouldn't want to see those changed. Maybe they could do like a prequel, like maybe go back before when Geralt first became a Witcher or something like that. I don't know if that's covered in the first two games or not. But
So all of the games take place after the last book. I would be interested. I guess they'd have to keep it a little bit more linear because they'd have to stick to the plots of the books. But just doing games of the books would be pretty damn cool. Granted, I mean that's going to be the ground that the Netflix series is going
to
be covering.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm actually really looking forward to that. I think that's coming out really soon too. Yeah. Right, the next maybe month or so.
They don't have an announced date yet. Just this year, so it has to be November or December.
It seems like a perfect kind of winter show to watch. You know, with all the
where they're so
kind of setting it in snowy lands and stuff. So that'll be really good.
The one thing they have to fix if they do another one is that dotted line on your map that tells you where to go and how sometimes it's just objectively wrong. I need that to fix real bad. I was hoping that would be fixed for this version, but nope.
Yeah, it's I agree there. It's led me astray a few times. So
like the way you get to your goals shouldn't be harder because of the map. It should be easier because you have a map, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate the concept of the dotted line, but it really, like when you're trying to cross a river, a lot of times it will just go, like it'll send you north for a while and then be like, oh, you went north too far, and then it'll send you south for a while, and it will never lead you to a bridge.
If you're going up, like up in terms of elevation, it always gets screwed up. It tries to go around the whole structure, and it's really
bad. Yeah, yeah.
Call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order
again. Well, that music is telling us that it's time for last call. And I've changed up tonight's topic a little bit, because initially I had the last call discussion being whether Witcher 3 is the best RPG of all time. I just don't think any of the three of us would debate that. I think we all have a Japanese RPG that would
maybe he does.
If we add Japanese RPGs into it, then Xenoblade X becomes a problem, and I don't know which one would win, but I'd have to think
maybe
about
a bigger
it more.
Decision than Last Call will allow for.
Yeah, well, I think the more spirited debate might be whether it's the best Western RPG of all time.
That I can 100% agree with. I think before this I would have said Skyrim, but this game is amazing. It got me to read a giant series of books and go back and play old games. It was one of the reasons I bought a PC, was so that I could play the first one finally, which is not worth it. The first Witcher game isn't very good. But it's an amazing game.
Yeah, personally, I'm not ready to make the call that it's the best Western. It's funny that you bring up Skyrim, because I think that would be my first go-to for best. My second go-to would probably be Dragon Age.
Yeah, I was hoping you would say that, David. That's out there for me.
Yeah, I haven't played enough Dragon Age. I need to play... I've played a chunk of the first one. But I need to play more of them.
Just finish the first one. It's still the best one, I think. Origin? Three isn't
bad. That's what
Inquisition isn't bad, but Origins is, I think, Origins.
The second one was done by a different studio,
it plays
correct?
Very differently.
I thought I had heard
it's
that.
Very different.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so the first Dragon Age is almost the RPG-like in the sense of there's like a ton of customization. Like, and I think that was what happened, is that BioWare, they got a little bit cold feet after the first one, because I think a lot of people were complaining it was too complicated. So the pendulum went way too far for the second one. And then for Inquisition, I think they kind of went back to the middle ground, and it's not as complicated as Origins, but gave people what they were missing from Origins that they didn't like. I don't even remember the second one's what it's called, because it was I just didn't like
it. It's just Dragon Age 2. It's Dragon Age 2. Yeah.
The most creative of titles. That's interesting that you say that, because that's how I felt about the first two Mass Effect games. Is the first one had a lot more deep RPG elements, and then they simplified it a ton for the second one. Which I might say the first Mass Effect might be on my listing for top whatever Western RPGs.
Yeah, I'm gonna.
It's not winning, but I really. I'm gonna love jump that in
here because the Mass Effect series is the one that I'm leaning towards here. I really like Mass Effect 1. I think some of the choices and the quest design, I think, is really smart. I think Mass Effect 2 is probably the best Western RPG of all time, and I believe me, it's very close between that and Witcher. What makes me give Mass Effect 2 the nod is the relationships you have with the characters. I've never played another game where the Shepard and all the people that you meet, the relationships, the bonds you form with them, I don't think they've ever been stronger. You meet all the characters in very interesting missions to acquire them, and then you play through loyalty missions that help you understand, you know, more of their backstory, who they are, their problems, their perspectives on life. And ultimately, the decisions you make determine which characters die or live, or, you know, which, you know, if you, maybe you can save all of them and get a good ending or something like that. But Mass Effect 2, yeah, to me, Witcher 3 overall is probably the better Western RPG, but there's something really, really special about Mass Effect 2 and the character relationships that I don't think has been surpassed.
They should put that trilogy on Switch. You can throw Andromeda in.
I was just saying that. I was saying to Neil today.
I think Andromeda got probably more hate than it deserved. It's nowhere near the trilogy, but it's a perfectly serviceable game. It's a fine game.
I'll tell you what really turned me off of it was half of like the story payoff things glitched out for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't even get to see the scenes. They didn't even play out because of the glitches. I'm like, I spent, you know, so many hours, you know, forming these bonds with characters or making, you know, playing through the game, and then the payoffs, I didn't get any of them because they, like, I swear, two or three like really, really key scenes in the last, you know, 10% of the game glitched out. I was so choked by that. I was like, sucks.
And to be fair, I did play through it much later.
I played it much, which was definitely a mistake.
Yeah, so it was probably a much better experience than it was for you.
I might be alone on this one too, but I would throw the Fallout series in there too.
Get the hell out of here, David.
I could see that. I would love the Fallout series. There was a time where I would pick Fallout over Elder Scrolls.
Okay.
But I hated Fallout 4, and it hasn't gotten. I don't think Fallout has had its Skyrim moment. Like, there were great Elder Scrolls games before Skyrim, but Skyrim combined accessibility with depth so well. And I don't think Fallout has gotten there.
Hold on, John.
Yet.
Have you even tried Fallout 76 first? Have you not joined that $100 a year club?
Oh, I mean, of course.
That's the Skyrim of the Fallout series.
Yeah. God, poor Fallout.
Just a quick. David, let me do a quick tangent here because it's so stupid.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys saw on social media, like, people playing Fallout 76 are ganging up against people
that have
paid the $100 fee or on that Fallout 76 first club, because they get these exclusive icons so you know who they are in game. So people are ganging up against them, like trying to kill them and grief them and stuff like that. It's hilarious.
There's class warfare going on in Fallout 76.
It's so entertaining. Like, it's a total dumpster fire, right? But like, I love seeing something like that. So dumb.
Who would have thought that Bethesda could look out across the total shitstorm of Fallout 76 and then somehow say, hold my beer as they make
this
it
was
worse.
Like a couple days after they delayed the big NPC expansion, right? With all the human NPCs that were added, that they said, oh no, can we get more of your money now? We'll give you the content. Oh, it's just such a joke.
That's
such a joke.
I missed I miss 360 and PS3 era Bethesda.
Yeah, I mean, they
were once one of my favorites.
Stick to what you know, like pretty much. They do the single multiplayer experience, like terrific. Mm-hmm. Like, just give me a really good Fallout 5.
Yeah,
I'm very excited to. We'll see if I can hold off on Outer Worlds until it comes to Switch. I'm trying
to do that. I want to know what the date is going to be. Like, if it's next winter, like I probably will get it earlier.
I think it's first or second.
That's what I thought
quarter.
Too. That's what I thought. But you know, again, the games get delayed all the time, especially you know a port on Switch. I could see it getting pushed or something.
So here's the two deals. There's now you could play the game now for $5, or you can wait 6 months and play it at $90.
But
$90.
He's talking about
Canada. Oh, you're in Canada. Yeah. I was like, how much are they charging for this game?
It's going to be $79.99. It is $79.99 in Canada. Like, I was at EB the other day, and the PS4 and Xbox versions are $79.99. I got Game Pass for $5 a month, and I've already got it on my PC and playing it.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, I'll wait for the Switch version for portability, because that's RPG... Like, I don't care how many graphical downgrades I have to deal with. Big RPGs.
Yeah, it's not a big RPG
is
though.
I know it's more like a linear RPG, but it still has
apparently
side quests.
It's very replayable. Like a lot of like big decisions that you make that can change it significantly. That's what I've
heard. It's short but replayable. Like you can play it a lot. Like you'll beat it in under a week. But you can play it a few times.
But that's the kind of game I want to own, right? I want to own a game where I can beat it, put it down for a month, and then play it again. Believe me, I'm not debating the value of Game Pass. I think it's fantastic. But if you're not interested in the PC or Xbox ecosystem, then, you know, it is a game I think probably going to be worth owning. The reviews seem quite strong. So we'll see what the port looks like.
Yeah, if it goes on a really good sale on one of the other systems before then. I do like owning games physically, so... the Game Pass has never been my thing. But if it goes on a really good sale before the Switch version comes out, I may give in and just buy it on there because I really want to play it.
Well, I would have to assume that the Xbox version of the game will be on sale any day now.
Well, Black Friday, right? Yeah. I mean, that's got to be happening soon, too.
That's true.
Hmm. Alrighty. Did you guys have any final thoughts before we... wrap a bow on the Witcher 3 episode?
For the last call, I want to state my final opinion. I think it's that Witcher 3 and Mass Effect 2, like, to me, it's a coin flip between which one is the best Western RPG of all time. Skyrim's up there. I think, just personally, I think it's a little bit behind the other two because of the blank slate aspect of it. But, it's close. Witcher 3, maybe with the DLC, it could be the best Western RPG of all time. The Blood and Wine DLC, it still boggles my mind how sizable it is.
Is it possible that it could be the best Western RPG of all time without it being your favorite Western RPG?
I'm just not ready to, you know, extract those two things or to separate them, you know.
Sure.
Like, there are things that Witcher 3 doesn't do that Mass Effect 2 does so much better. And it, to me, that's why it's kind of any given day. I'm also just coming off of playing The Witcher 3 again. I haven't played Mass Effect 2 in, you know, 8 to 10 years or something like that. So it's been a long time.
I'm not that objective. I'm not that objective though, John. I think with my heart.
That's the conclusion I've had to come to with Xenoblade X. Is I know it's not the best JRPG of all time, but it sure is my favorite.
You're asking the guy who gave Final Fantasy VIII a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
David, you've given everything a 10 this year. So, I mean, that to give Final Fantasy VIII a 10 is, you know, par for the course, I feel like.
I've given all the good games a 10 this year.
Okay, let's go back through the list of games you reviewed. Hold on, let me bring up OpenCritic for a second.
They're mostly Final Fantasy and AI.
That's right, yeah.
I don't think AI is even on that list.
It's not on the list. It's not on the OpenCritic list because it was a video only
one.
That's right. I'm gonna have to bullshit a written review somewhere in the depths of our website just so that it can be on my list.
Use the YouTube subtitle generator.
To create a written review of it.
And then just post that with no editing onto the site.
That's right. And it just change the author to John, and you'll be good.
Perfect.
Alrighty, well, this is a great talk about Witcher 3. It's a fun game to play. Highly recommend if you haven't picked it up yet, or to replay it again if you own it. I will also just say that if Andrew's listening, I know I've had your copy of Witcher 3 for many years now, but I finally played it, and I'm not ready to give it back yet, so thank you. So if you want to check out John's Witcher 3 for Switch review, it's on NintendoWorldReport.com. It's also on NWR TV, a great video review of it, so you can check it out for yourself if you want to take a look at it. And also, just a reminder that we do have a Discord channel now for the Thirsty Mage. So we have the games that we're currently playing and some of the games that we will be playing if you wanted to join with us and play along and share some experiences or get some hints or that sort of thing.
And can you just leave the Witcher 3 channel open forever?
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to close any of the games.
I'm not going to stop playing ever. So.
No, we're going to leave them open. That's the thing with RPGs. They're timeless, so people can get in and out of them all the time.
Especially the one we're playing next week.
Yeah, exactly. And if anyone ever has any game recommendations that you'd like us to talk about, or if you have a topic for Last Call that you'd like us to discuss, feel free to email me at david@thethirstymage.com or hit us up on Twitter and just you can drop it in publicly or send a DM, just let us know if there's anything you'd like to hear.
I think someone requested Moonlighter at some point. We haven't forgotten about that. It might slip into January or something, but we are trying to kind of, you know, get our ducks in a row and figure out our upcoming schedule for the next few months. So individual games like that have a much better shot now with a weekly format, and Moonlighter is something I was thinking about today. We've got Final Fantasy 1 coming up next week, so you can look forward to that, and a lot of other cool games coming up in November, December.
Perfect. So I want to thank everyone for listening, and make sure to subscribe, and if you have some time, to leave us a review. But other than that, we'll see you out at the next episode. Goodbye.
Bye. See ya.
I know you're Canadian. Your Canadian blood is compelling you to fight them, right? To drop the gloves, but you don't have to fight everybody.